Welcome back to the program. We're going to spend some time talking about a very dark world, the world of homelessness and drug addiction in the contemporary American city. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Philippe Bourgois. He's the author of the multiple award-winning In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in El Barrio. He's the Richard Perry University Professor of Anthropology and Family and Community Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and the co-author of a new book entitled Righteous Dope Fiend, just published by University of California Press. Philippe, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the air.
Great to have you here. What got you interested originally in taking a look at this world of homelessness and drug addiction on America's streets?
You know, I grew up in New York City, right on the dividing line between the poorest census district in the city of New York and the richest. I was on the richest side. But literally just 50 yards away began East Harlem, which at that time was next to the South Bronx, one of the poorest census districts in the city. So I've always been interested in how our society organizes, structures, and reproduces these extraordinary levels of poverty in the midst of wealth. And of course, the Bay Area is extraordinary. We have the highest per capita income levels in the nation, if you take the whole Bay Area as a whole. Yet we also have one of the highest levels of homelessness in the nation. And so that's what this book sought to part of what this book, Righteous Dope Fiend, seeks to explore. How is it that we've produced so many thousands of people who have destroyed their lives and are being destroyed, primarily through substance abuse in the context of abject poverty, with virtually no coherent services and resources to reach out to them?
There is also this sense, as one looks at it, and your example of New York is also the same thing, that there's a kind of lottery quality to it. You walk down the streets and, you know, one person got the right lottery ticket, one person didn't.
You know, absolutely. One of the things that's extraordinary to see is how long it takes someone to become homeless and how much bad luck is involved. So if you, first of all, family, I mean, the luck of what family you're born into is, you know, number one. And or actually, it's more like your zip code. What zip code you're born into is incredibly determining. And then it's if you stumble on, there are some public subsidized housing arrangements that we have in this country. Unfortunately, there's fewer and fewer since the 1980s. We started cutting out federal funds for providing subsidized housing. But if you're one of the lucky few who are in subsidized housing, you can stay housed.
Of course, one of the other aspects of this is the impact that drugs have had on this population over the years.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a terrible tragedy, and it's very poorly understood. Why do we consume so many toxic drugs in the United States? We specifically consume, you know, among the worst, cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin. You know, marijuana is now the drug of choice among youth, and that's less damaging, obviously, than the narcotics I just mentioned. But along with alcohol, our poor have enough money. There's enough resources in the United States for international smugglers to bring the worst drugs to us. Mm-hmm. Whereas in many, you know, poorer countries, that's just not an option. When you're poor, you're basically limited to you know, what you can produce in your own country.
Another aspect of this story, and you include so much of this in Righteous Dope Fiend, is the families of these people and the price they pay, the parents, the children, the grandchildren, etc.
Yeah, especially the mothers. We followed about two dozen men and women on the streets of San Francisco. They were living underneath the highways in downtown San Francisco. And all of them at one point in their life, except maybe one or two, had been married or called themselves married and had kids. None of them, of course, had a real relationship with their kids at this point. They'd been thrown out of their houses. And many of them kept an ongoing relationship with their own mothers when those mothers were alive. and continued to go back to them for help and so forth in many cases. And it was just terrible to see how those poor mothers would get ripped apart by the mess in the lives of, often it's a son with a mother, but also daughters with their mothers, and grandmothers even, in some cases.
Do you ever see any of these lives really turn around?
Yes, absolutely. And that is, I mean, there is a good message that can come out from the tragedy of homelessness in America, and that is people are capable of completely transforming. And the problem is there aren't enough programs and services that allow those who want to transform themselves to enable that process. And it's also a complicated process. The transformation process often, especially when there's intense substance abuse, especially when there's heroin injection involved, often, you know, involves backsliding. It involves recidivism. That's a natural process of the recovery process. Just like with domestic, you know, abuse, wife battering, most women who finally leave the man who's been beating them, you know, have to leave seven to 13 times, I think the statistics say, before they finally get out of that abusive relationship. Heroin is often the same thing. People, you know, they want to get out of it, they try to get out of it, they successfully get out of it for a few weeks, for a few months, sometimes even for a year, and then boom, they slide back into it. Crack is the same way. Cocaine and methamphetamine are the same way. So you see a lot of recidivism, and it's very frustrating to families and to service providers because it looks to you like the person is in bad faith when in fact it's the nature of addiction. It's an extraordinarily, you know, it's an extraordinarily debilitating, overwhelming monkey on your back to be addicted.
And with respect to that addiction, to what extent is oftentimes permanent damage done that makes the recovery process that much harder?
You know, what's amazing is that a drug like heroin, when it's administered to you pure, does not damage your organs. It's not like cocaine or, you know, nicotine or drugs like that, or alcohol for that matter. It doesn't actually decay your organs. So you could live forever, basically. I mean, you know, live a normal life, except that you'd be, you know, high on opiates all the time if you were administered heroin. So heroin itself isn't the problem in terms of your health. What happens is your heroin makes you physically addicted, so it gets into your cellular structures so that your cells can no longer operate without the opiate proteins. And so as soon as you don't have enough heroin, nothing is functioning. Everything is hurting you. All the cells that are supposed to do what they do make you digest, make you, you know, not, you know, whatever, see and feel decently and so forth, can't do what they're supposed to do. So you just feel terrible. You fall apart. You start itching all over. You start, everything just starts pouring out of you because your cells can't control itself. So you're throwing up, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go in the details. Right. They're too horrible. And so that's what is so tremendously horrible about heroin is this physical addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine, however, doesn't have that same physical addiction. It has a psychological addiction, so that you can no longer feel the normal amounts of pleasure in your steady state anymore because your brain has been so bombarded with the cocaine, you know, super excitement of pleasure that it's shut itself down. So you go into a deep depression when you stop using the cocaine. And that's what people face, and they start craving the cocaine in order to reach its steady state of just not being depressed. But it's not a physical, you know, it doesn't physically take over your body in the same way that heroin does.
Mm-hmm.
So people actually can quit cocaine cold turkey, you know, without as much problem as with heroin. With heroin, however, they go through 5 days of just excruciating pain. There are medications that they can give them now, and San Francisco has some great programs. The Bay Area has some great programs for that.
Of course, the other thing that we see in many of these situations is deteriorating health overall because of the lack of availability of health care for these people.
Right.
And all of that just contributes
to the
downward spiral.
They're taking the drugs in very, very, very unsanitary conditions. So because you know, everything they're doing more or less is illegal, they find themselves injecting in the absolutely filthiest nooks and crannies where they've taken refuge so that the police won't see them or so that passersby won't see them. And that's like an ideal place to propagate bacteria, viruses, and so forth. So they're constantly living with abscesses, sores, and, you know, spreading HIV and hepatitis C. Those are the two infectious diseases that are, you know, that are most deadly. But they're above all just spreading bacteria, giving themselves terrible and often very costly infections that you know get into their bloodstreams, into their hearts, and things like
right.
that. But you know, ironically, when we looked, you know, over the 12 years that we spent out on the streets with the homeless, basically hanging out in their homeless encampments, sometimes sleeping in their encampments to get to know them better and to break through the impressions management types of presentations that, you know, that anyone will try to give a professor when he comes in saying, tell me about your life. What we found was they were actually dying of things like throat cancer and cirrhosis of the liver. So alcohol and cigarettes are actually major killers of the homeless, rather than you know, the heroin per se.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about best practices that you've seen, what you've seen going on in some cities that really have been helpful to this population.
Yeah, great question, because we've really learned a lot in the past 10 years, and there are some things that work well. San Francisco's Housing First program has been a remarkable success. And I say this quite humbly because most of the people working in the field were actually very suspicious of Gavin Newsom's proposal when he first proposed it, which basically what he did was he lowered the amount of welfare payments, GA it's called in San Francisco, payments that are given to the homeless, to single homeless men and women. And it's so that they only receive something very, you know, very trivial, like $50. And instead, he invested all that other money in building permanent multi-service housing. So, you know, everyone was skeptical, would he really build the house? Not only did he build that housing, but he built a lot more. So San Francisco now basically has this strategy that's been very effective of taking the, you know, sort of the most devastated of the homeless, basically anyone who's homeless who applies for it, you know, will be considered, and putting them into subsidized, basically SRO hotels, you know, the single residence occupancy hotels that they've renovated, and then giving access to social workers, to drug treatment, to, you know, a whole slew of services to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the city pays directly their rent with their welfare check. So this has been very successful. It's taken a lot of people off the streets who used to be suffering a great deal and also used to be extraordinarily expensive. I mean, they were getting picked up and sent to the emergency room. You know how much it costs. I don't know
right.
if anyone's been to the emergency room. It costs a fortune. And that had to be picked up by, you know, taxpayers, basically, all these unnecessary emergency room visits. And when you're living, you know, under the rain, filth, you just get sick all the time. So it's been a very cost-effective program to build subsidized housing and provide, you know, a certain level of services. And the magic to the San Francisco program is that it tolerates non-disruptive substance use. So it's not asking them to completely stop using drugs, because that's just not realistic. If you do that, they're going to be kicked out and they're going to be on the streets and the same problem over. So instead, it says you can, you know, do what you do. It's not none of our business, as long as you're not disturbing, you know, the other residents in the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it's sort of called a harm reduction approach to housing. As a result, you get people who become stable, and then they start being able to deal with all their other problems of, you know, whether it be finding a job or seeking mental health services, or, you know, just figuring out who they are in life so that they can less destructively take drugs. And some of them actually succeed in stopping completely.
Talk a little bit about what places like New York have done.
New York actually had the Housing First model before San Francisco. If folks in San Francisco was more holier than thou, but in fact, New York was the place that claims that it invented it, although Philadelphia also claims that it invented it. I mean, to a certain extent, it's common sense if you stop and think about it. You know, you want to get people off the streets, you've got to give them a cheap place, and then you've got to provide them with some supportive services, and you can't set up too many rules, or they're going to be back out on the streets again. So so New York City did that earlier than everyone else, and on a much more massive level, because New York has more abandoned buildings because of how the housing market is than San Francisco. So the city is a humongous landlord, and it was able to create huge amounts of housing.
Mm-hmm. What is the recidivism rate among those people that actually get into this housing?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know the actual statistics. I'm a cultural anthropologist, so I have trouble adding and counting, as we say. But those statistics probably exist, and you know, they're always going to be higher than you would want them to be, because this is a difficult population. This is a population that's had long-term problems, so you can't expect miracles. And that's part of what sort of confuses and frustrates many people, is you want people to immediately get better when you provide them with, you know, what you think they need, when in fact it often takes someone quite a while to sort of adapt to turning their life around. But I don't know the actual numbers. But I do know the guys in my scene. We worked, you know, over the 12 years that we were out there on the streets. We were following basically a social network. So, and there'd be about 12 people or so, 10, 12 people in that social network. There'd be a set of guys with a few women living in these homeless encampments and in abandoned cars and vans and stuff like that. And they would, you know, come and go depending on who would go into treatment, who would get arrested, who would disappear, who would be running away from someone trying to kill them, and so forth. So we got to know very well over the 12 years about 75 people. And, you know, I would say that probably over half or about half are dead now. They have a very, very high mortality rate. And then another maybe quarter are successfully housed in that program.
As you got to know them, as you learned more about their lives, were there discernible patterns with respect to their lives that you began to see?
Yes, yes, absolutely. First of all, there's a big demographic divide among the homeless. There's a set of homeless throughout the United States, and this is very, you know, very visible in the Bay Area. You have the older homeless, the Vietnam generation homeless, and these people are getting very old now. These people are, you know, hitting 50, 60, and they're still out there, still pounding heroin, if you can believe it, still smoking crack. I mean, these 60-year-olds smoking crack, it's hard to believe, isn't it? And drinking huge amounts of this wretched stuff. They shouldn't even sell it. It's Cisco Berry. It's just, they call it liquid crack, and it's just a disgrace. It's a wine cooler that just completely destroys your liver. Anyhow, so there's that big sort of demographic cohort, and then, you know, then you have the younger group, you know, that often in the Bay Area they're very sort of subculturally identified as sort of they you know, with piercings and a punk look or a hippie look, and they maintain themselves generally separately from the older folks. And what you find is there are that the vast majority of them come from very poor families. So it's interesting because if, you know, when people walk around, let's say the Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco, they'll get the impression that these kids are just a bunch of snot-nosed rich kids who, you know, don't know what to do better in life. When in fact, when you probe into their lives, it turns out that they grew up in trailer parks. Often their parents were alcoholics or heroin addicts themselves, and that they've had very, very difficult lives of abuse. There are a few wealthy people who fall apart. I mean, you know, addiction is universal in that sense, and they suffered obviously just as much on the street. But the vast majority are people from very poor, disadvantaged backgrounds. Often there's been physical, emotional, and even sexual abuse, especially among the women, in their backgrounds, and that's what sent them out to the street. The men don't like to talk about that as much, but 100% of the women, literally 100% of the women we interviewed in the older scene, when we would do life histories of them, would describe these horrific tales of sexual abuse and physical abuse in their childhood stories. And as a matter of fact, in the younger group, we did manage to find a woman who didn't have a horrible tale, and she was saying, you know, I feel strange. I'm the only person who likes their parents. I had a nice family. The others, you know, just had horrific stories.
To what extent is mental illness a big part of this as opposed to just economic dislocation?
Well, we estimate that, you know, mental illness is a slippery concept because it's hard to stay sane when you're out on the street. But as in someone who is mentally ill and becomes homeless, already mentally ill, I would estimate, or the estimates range around 30%. But people that are out there on the street, once you've been out there on the street for several years, you're first of all, you're going to get, you know, what we call PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's so violent out there. If you're a woman, forget it. It's just incredibly violent against women. And, I mean, it's almost impossible not to get some kind of, you know, emotional type pathology living in that environment, and it's really sad to see that. You get depressed, you get anxious, you get but in terms of sort of the schizophrenic who's talking to themselves, it's about 30%. What's tragic about that is that they're wandering around talking to themselves, and because there's so much drugs out there, they just sort of stumble into starting to smoke crack or inject heroin, and they're completely, you know, they have no business doing that, and they don't really know what they're doing. What they say is that the people that are absolutely worst off are the high-functioning mentally ill, because they're high-functioning enough so that they can, you know, not get completely beaten up by everyone, and they're able to get enough money to get drugs, and so they manage to destroy themselves even more. But the guys we studied were not, you know, I mean, we didn't actually, our network wouldn't tolerate those who were, you know, organically mentally ill in the sense that, you know, were visibly talking to themselves or not, you know, that someone walking by would identify that person belongs, you know, in psychiatric care. So our scene was just people who were long-term homeless who, you know, were very, very functional, very smart. They were survivors, and you have to be smart to survive on the street.
How was it possible to do this project for as long as you guys did it, and at the same time not either feel depressed all the time or just feel this compelling need to want to do something all the time?
Well, we did feel a compelling need to do something all the time. You're absolutely right, and we did get depressed a lot. It is a very depressing scene. The way I deal with it as an anthropologist, I mean, my previous book was with crack dealers, the one you mentioned at first, In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in El Barrio. That was I lived for 5 years next to a crack house in East Harlem and made friends with the crack dealers and then got into their families. That was a little bit easier because they were young. They were much more violent, so it was much scarier in terms of the levels of violence. And that was in the late 1980s and early 1990s, so there was a tremendous amount of killing going on in New York City streets at that time. You know, it was the height of the crack epidemic. And but that was easier because they felt themselves to be at the height of their career. You know, they were full of hope, full of an American dream of get rags to riches, get rich quick, you know, by any means necessary. Whereas the guys that we were with that are the main characters of Righteous Dope Fiend are a lot sadder. They're the people that are at the end of the ropes. The thing that's positive about it, and that does make me, you know, that we would hold on to, is that there's a lot that can be done with them. As a society, there really is a set of concrete policies and programs that we can institute that would lower their suffering a tremendous amount, and that wouldn't be that expensive. As a matter of fact, it would actually lower the amount of money that society spends on them. Because right now, the insane thing is that we have a set of policies that really make the homeless as expensive as they possibly could be. Because the only way that they get any sort of coherent, hands-on treatment is in jail. And you can't get a more expensive place than jail. So our whole war on drugs strategy towards, you know, the individual addict has been a terrible waste of money, and it, basically the only place people get treatment, or the place where most addicts get treatment is, you know, on the cold hard floor of a holding cell. They go into withdrawals while they're waiting to see the judge, and it's just a ridiculous way to treat them. And then it turns out to be very expensive. You know how much, you know, a person in jail costs per year. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And tell us a little bit about this volume, Righteous Dope Fiend, and the photographs that accompany it.
Yeah. Jeff Schoenberg, my co-author, is a photographer and an anthropologist. I'm an anthropologist. And he had his camera on him the whole time. And while he was taking, you know, at the same time as he took notes and tape recorded and slept in the encampment and so forth, he was also snapping pictures. And he's a beautiful photographer. And so the photographs are the kind of intimate photographs that you can only get when you become very close to people and spend, you know, and practically an obsessive amount of time with them. And we're making an argument for a new way of doing anthropology and presenting, you know, urgent social burning questions to the public. We're calling it photoethnography, where we wrap the photographs around the text so that the reader gets a better, sort of more organic and emotional gut understanding of what we're talking about. Because a lot of the stuff that we're describing is just sort of hard to believe, how filthy it is, how it, also just the positive things, the love between the homeless, you know, and then their ingenious strategies for making money. So we actually have photographs of them in their burglaries. We have photographs of them, you know, shooting up together. We have photographs of them in the hospital being mistreated and so forth.
Philippe Bergois, the book is Righteous Dope Fiend. It's just out from University of California Press. Philippe, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for talking to me.